what they call him. Way down Mexicali way, senoritas falling for him, with the hope that he will stay. By the time that they love him, senor blues done gone away. Well, he's tall and good looking, and he always knows just what to say. Yes, he's tall and good looking, oh, and he always knows just what to say. By the time that they love him, el señor blues done gone away.
That's a great Taj Mahal singing and playing on his specialized dobro guitar with Senor Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is, my goodness, could it have come this fast? It's Thursday, December the 5th. And in Illinois, a battle is brewing between the state and a coalition of unions that is expected by as early as tomorrow to sue over legislation passed just Tuesday that they say is unfair to workers and retirees. On Tuesday, both houses of the democratically controlled state legislature passed a measure to restore $160 billion to the state budget by making deep cuts in workers' and retirees' pension plans. So, indeed, Detroit was, in many, many ways, the first domino to fall. Well, your president made a speech yesterday. He was in very friendly territory. He was, in fact, at the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. It's a think tank. And he waxed philosophic about deeply entrenched problems, social and economic, that require legislative action and political prodding, especially from the affected groups. But as you would see, actually, as you would hear from this excerpt of the speech, there are many ironies that escaped even him. So we will listen to this excerpt, which pretty much presents the core points that he made in his speech, and then we will disassemble it and do so in our tradition, our grand tradition at Lead Stories. We will disassemble it with great insight, and then we come back to that discussion right after we listen to this excerpt. So here is President Barack Obama talking about inequality. And very interesting, very, very interesting. I'm looking to see your analytical prowess as you listen to this speech and come back after it. It's a long enough speech. It's about, I think, about 20 minutes worth, to give us a great sense, to give a sense of what it is he covered, the ground he covered when he spoke yesterday. And so let's get started. Here's Barack Obama.
Now, over the last 2 months, Washington's been dominated by some pretty contentious debates. I think that's fair to say. And between a reckless shutdown by congressional Republicans in an effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and admittedly, poor execution on my administration's part in implementing the latest stage of the new law, nobody's acquitted themselves very well these past few months. So it's not surprising that the American people's frustrations with Washington are at an all-time high. But we know that people's frustrations run deeper than these most recent political battles. Their frustrations rooted in their own daily battles to make ends meet, to pay for college, buy a home, save for retirement. It's rooted in the nagging sense that no matter how hard they work, the deck is stacked against them. And it's rooted in the fear that their kids won't be better off than they were. They may not follow the constant back and forth in Washington or all the policy details, but they experience in a very personal way the relentless decades-long trend that I want to spend some time talking about today, and that is a dangerous and growing inequality and lack of upward mobility that has jeopardized middle-class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead. I believe this is the defining challenge of our time, making sure our economy works for every working American. That's why I ran for president. It was the center of last year's campaign. It drives everything I do in this office. And I know I've raised this issue before, and some will ask why I raise the issue again right now. I do it because the outcomes of the debates we're having right now, whether it's health care or the budget or reforming our housing and financial systems, all these things will have real practical implications for every American. And I am convinced that the decisions we make on these issues over the next few years will determine whether or not our children will grow up in an America where opportunity is real. Now, the premise that we're all created equal is the opening line in the American story. And while we don't promise equal outcomes, we've strived to deliver equal opportunity. The idea that success doesn't depend on being born into wealth or privilege, it depends on effort and merit. And with every chapter we've added to that story, we've worked hard to put those words into practice. It was Abraham Lincoln, a self-described poor man's son, who started a system of land-grant colleges all over this country so that any poor man's son could go learn something new. When farms gave way to factories, a rich man's son named Teddy Roosevelt fought for an 8-hour workday, protections for workers, and busted monopolies that kept prices high and wages low. When millions lived in poverty, FDR fought for Social Security and insurance for the unemployed and a minimum wage. When millions died without health insurance, LBJ fought for Medicare and Medicaid. Together, we forged a new deal, declared a war on poverty and a great society. We built a ladder of opportunity to climb and stretched out a safety net beneath so that if we fell, it wouldn't be too far and we could bounce back. And as a result, America built the largest middle class the world has ever known. And for the three decades after World War II, it was the engine of our prosperity. Now, we can't look at the past through rose-colored glasses. The economy didn't always work for everyone. Racial discrimination locked millions out of poverty or out of opportunity. Women were too often confined to a handful of often poorly paid professions. And it was only through painstaking struggle that more women and minorities and Americans with disabilities began to win the right to more fairly and fully participate in the economy. Nevertheless, during the post-World War II years, the economic ground felt stable and secure for most Americans, and the future looked brighter than the past. And for some, that meant following in your old man's footsteps at the local plant, and you knew that a blue-collar job would let you buy a home and a car, maybe a vacation once in a while, health care, a reliable pension. For others, it meant going to college. In some cases, maybe the first in your family to go to college. And it meant graduating without taking on loads of debt and being able to count on advancement through a vibrant job market. Now, it's true that those at the top, even in those years, claimed a much larger share of income than the rest. The top 10% consistently took home about one-third of our national income. But that kind of inequality took place in a dynamic market economy where everyone's wages and incomes were growing. And because of upward mobility, the guy on the factory floor could picture his kid running the company someday. But starting in the late 70s, this social compact began to unravel. Technology made it easier for companies to do more with less, eliminating certain job occupations. A more competitive world let companies ship jobs anywhere. And as good manufacturing jobs automated or headed offshore, workers lost their leverage, jobs paid less, and offered fewer benefits. As values of community broke down and competitive pressure increased, businesses lobbied Washington to weaken unions and the value of the minimum wage. As a trickle-down ideology became more prominent, taxes were slashed for the wealthiest, while investments in things that make us all richer, like schools and infrastructure, were allowed to wither. And for a certain period of time, we could ignore this weakening economic foundation, in part because more families were relying on two earners as women entered the workforce. We took on more debt financed by a juiced-up housing market. But when the music stopped and the crisis hit, millions of families were stripped of whatever cushion they had left. And the result is an economy that's become profoundly unequal and families that are more insecure. I'll just give you a few statistics. Since 1979, when I graduated from high school, our productivity is up by more than 90%. But the income of the typical family has increased by less than 8%. Since 1979, our economy has more than doubled in size. But most of that growth has flowed to a fortunate few. The top 10% no longer takes in one-third of our income. It now takes half. Whereas in the past, the average CEO made about 20 to 30 times the income of the average worker, today's CEO now makes 273 times more. And meanwhile, a family in the top 1% has a net worth 288 times higher than the typical family, which is a record for this country. So the basic bargain at the heart of our economy has frayed. In fact, this trend towards growing inequality is not unique to America's market economy. Across the developed world, inequality has increased. Some of you may have seen just last week, the Pope himself spoke about this at eloquent length. How can it be, he wrote, that it's not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points? But this increasing inequality is most pronounced in our country, and it challenges the very essence of who we are as a people. Understand, we've never begrudged success in America. We aspire to it. We admire folks who start new businesses, create jobs, and invent the products that enrich our lives, and we expect them to be rewarded handsomely for it. In fact, we've often accepted more income inequality than many other nations for one big reason, because we were convinced that America is a place where even if you're born with nothing, with a little hard work, you can improve your own situation over time and build something better to leave your kids. As Lincoln once said, while we do not propose any war upon capital, we do wish to allow the humblest man an equal chance to get rich with everybody else. The problem is that alongside increased inequality, we've seen diminished levels of upward mobility in recent years. A child born in the top 20% has about a 2 in 3 chance of staying at or near the top. A child born into the bottom 20% has a less than 1 in 20 shot at making it to the top. He's 10 times likelier to stay where he is. In fact, statistics show not only that our levels of income inequality rank near countries like Jamaica and Argentina, but that it is harder today for a child born here in America to improve her station in life than it is for children in most of our wealthy allies, countries like Canada or Germany or France. They have greater mobility than we do, not less. And the idea that so many children are born into poverty in the wealthiest nation on earth is heartbreaking enough. But the idea that a child may never be able to escape that poverty because she lacks a decent education or health care or a community that views her future as their own, that should offend all of us. And it should compel us to action. We are a better country than this. So let me repeat. The combined trends of increased inequality and decreasing mobility pose a fundamental threat to the American dream, our way of life, and what we stand for around the globe. And it is not simply a moral claim that I'm making here. There are practical consequences to rising inequality and reduced mobility. For one thing, these trends are bad for our economy. One study finds that growth is more fragile and recessions are more frequent in countries with greater inequality. And that makes sense. You know, when families have less to spend, that means businesses have fewer customers. And households rack up greater mortgage and credit card debt. Meanwhile, concentrated wealth at the top is less likely to result in the kind of broadly based consumer spending that drives our economy, and together with lax regulation may contribute to risky speculative bubbles. And rising inequality and declining mobility are also bad for our families and social cohesion. Not just because we tend to trust our institutions less, but studies show we actually tend to trust each other less when there's greater inequality. And greater inequality is associated with less mobility between generations. That means it's not just temporary. The effects last. It creates a vicious cycle. For example, by the time she turns 3 years old, a child born into a low-income home hears 30 million fewer words than a child from a well-off family, which means by the time she starts school, she's already behind. And that deficit can compound itself over time. And finally, rising inequality and declining mobility are bad for our democracy. Ordinary folks can't write massive campaign checks or hire high-priced lobbyists and lawyers to secure policies that tilt the playing field in their favor at everyone else's expense. And so people get the bad taste that the system's rigged. And that increases cynicism and polarization. And it decreases the political participation that is a requisite part of our system of self-government. So this is an issue that we have to tackle head on. And if, in fact, the majority of Americans agree that our number one priority is to restore opportunity and broad-based growth for all Americans, the question is, why has Washington consistently failed to act? I think a big reason is the myths that have developed around the issue of inequality. First, there's the myth that this is a problem restricted to a small share of predominantly minority poor. This isn't a broad-based problem. This is a black problem or a Hispanic problem or a Native American problem. Now, it's true that the painful legacy of discrimination means that African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans are far more likely to suffer from a lack of opportunity. Higher unemployment, higher poverty rates. It's also true that women still make 77 cents on the dollar compared to men. So we're going to need strong application of anti-discrimination laws. We're going to need immigration reform that grows the economy and takes people out of the shadows. We're going to need targeted initiatives to close those gaps. But here's an important point. The decades-long shifts in the economy have hurt all groups, poor and middle class, inner city and rural folks, men and women, and Americans of all races. And as a consequence, some of the social patterns that contribute to declining mobility that were once attributed to the urban poor, you know, that's a particular problem for the inner city. You know, single-parent households or drug abuse. Or it turns out now we're seeing that pop up everywhere. A new study shows that disparities in education, mental health, obesity, absent fathers, isolation from church, isolation from community groups, these gaps are now as much about growing up rich or poor as they are about anything else. The gap in test scores between poor kids and wealthy kids is now nearly twice what it is between white kids and black kids. Kids with working class parents are 10 times likelier than kids with middle or upper class parents to go through a time when their parents have no income. So the fact is this, the opportunity gap in America is now as much about class as it is about race. And that gap is growing. So if we're going to take on growing inequality and try to improve upward mobility for all people, we've got to move beyond the false notion that this is an issue exclusively of minority concern. And we have to reject a politics that suggests any effort to address it in a meaningful way somehow pits the interests of a deserving middle class against those of an undeserving poor in search of handouts. Second, we need to dispel the myth that the goals of growing the economy and reducing inequality are necessarily in conflict, when they should actually work in concert. We know from our history that our economy grows best from the middle out, when growth is more widely shared. And we know that beyond a certain level of inequality, growth actually slows altogether. Third, we need to set aside the belief that government cannot do anything about reducing inequality. It's true that government cannot prevent all the downsides of the technological change and global competition that are out there right now. And some of those forces are also some of the things that are helping us grow. And it's also true that some programs in the past, like welfare before it was reformed, were sometimes poorly designed, created disincentives to work. But we've also seen how government action time and again can make an enormous difference in increasing opportunity and bolstering ladders into the middle class. Investments in education, laws establishing collective bargaining and a minimum wage, these all contributed to rising standards of living for massive numbers of Americans. Likewise, when previous generations declared that every citizen of this country deserved a basic measure of security, the floor through which they could not fall, we helped millions of Americans live in dignity and gave millions more the confidence to aspire to something better by taking a risk on a great idea. You know, without Social Security, nearly half of seniors would be living in poverty. Half. Today, fewer than one in ten do. Before Medicare, only half of all seniors had some form of health insurance. Today, virtually all do. And because we've strengthened that safety net and expanded pro-work and pro-family tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, a recent study found that the poverty rate has fallen by 40% since the 1960s. And these endeavors didn't just make us a better country, they reaffirmed that we are a great country. So we can make a difference on this. In fact, that's our generation's task, to rebuild America's economic and civic foundation, to continue the expansion of opportunity for this generation and the next generation. And like Nira, I take this personally. I'm only here because this country educated my grandfather on the GI Bill. When my father left and my mom hit hard times trying to raise my sister and me while she was going to school, this country helped make sure we didn't go hungry. When Michelle, the daughter of a shift worker at a water plant and a secretary, wanted to go to college, just like me, this country helped us afford it until we could pay it back. So what drives me as a grandson, a son, a father, as an American, is to make sure that every striving, hardworking, optimistic kid in America has the same incredible chance that this country gave me.
Well, we do have a very interesting speech to discuss. I'm sure that you picked up on certain things, and you can share those things at 888-874-4888. We are having a technical problem, I'm told. For many of you, if you've tuned in and you didn't hear some part of the speech, it is because we were having a technical issue that is being resolved as I speak. The server is rebooting, I'm told, and in any event, this program will be available on the archives. But 888-874-4888, if you are hearing this program, do give us a call and get the conversation started. What is the significance of President Obama's speech? There are so many things that qualify. Just to remind you, this speech was held on friendly turf at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. We always talk about the importance of the environment of a story or an event. It's very important. And we can start there. What's the environment of the speech, and therefore how significant was it, especially with respect to what the president had to say? What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888. I'll be particularly interested in, when you call in, let me hear from you in very, very succinctly. What to your ear was very telling, very significant about this particular speech? What did the president say that perhaps rang louder this time than it did before? In what ways was the president either the same or different from previous speeches? What do you think the aim and objective are of the speech? What is he trying to accomplish? What is the context for the speech? All these things are very important because this is, in fact, a very significant speech. It tells us a lot about the president, and it tells us a lot about the polity, our whole political arena being shaped at this particular time. All right, let's see who will be calling in first. I know many of you may be having difficulty because you're not hearing this program right now, but we are continuing. Many of you are also hearing it, so we will continue, and we will do that. Let me just let you know about some programs that are coming up right after this. We'll take this break and come back to your calls at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. We just listened to a speech that President Obama made yesterday before the assembled crowd at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. And essentially, he was talking about income inequality being, as he put it, the defining challenge of our time. Well, of course, it's been the defining challenge of our time. Certainly, it has been the defining challenge of his administration and of previous administrations, but his administration particularly came into office. He came into office with this knowledge. This is nothing new. In fact, that was the reason that people were supporting him across the country, because there were particular constituencies that were seriously experiencing income inequality. And those constituencies voted overwhelmingly for him. And one would have thought that 5 years into office, by now we would have had some kind of signal from the White House that that mandate did register on him. We have no jobs program, and it still remains an issue of jobs, doesn't it? How do you achieve income equality? Income equality is achieved by income. And when you have an unemployment rate that is absolutely atrocious as it pertains to African Americans and Latinos particularly, to now in the fifth year advise the public that you are aware that income inequality is the defining issue, the defining challenge of our time. It may make you feel good, but at the same time, this is what people have been saying to you, Mr. President, for a long, long time now, 5 years. What is significant about the speech is that it is an interesting departure from the norm for the president to now link. He has discovered the nexus, as it were, between race and class and equality. That's really incredible. Because based on the way this president has been functioning, we didn't know that he actually, or anybody in his administration actually connected those dots. Race, class, and equality. They're all interconnected. But he does a very interesting thing in his speech, in that he still, even as he recognizes it, he still insists that everybody is to be treated the same. Even when he absolutely is clear that there are communities that are super, super distressed. The solution, he says, it's everybody should be treated the same. You know, going back to that silly quote, you know, talking about Abraham Lincoln, as if Abraham Lincoln or anybody of his ilk really did believe that all people were created equal. The notion that you could at once recognize a problem as having disproportionate impact in particular communities, and at the same time say that that does not merit a special attention. Those people will now have to be pleased with the fact that an across-the-board response is adequate. You have people in dire circumstances, but you insist on responding with a general solution. So what's the point? The point is this is the way political people talk. They're letting you know, I'm not unmindful of your problem, mind you, but here's the solution. Your problem really needs to fit within the context of the general solution. I don't get that. The president is clearly making a speech linking these three pieces of race, class, and equality, because he's in the environment, a liberal think tank. This is the kind of talk they talk. So he's letting them know we're of one mind. This speech comes before the 2014 elections. And it's a huge mandate. He's got to deliver. The Democratic Party has got to gain some ground. And the indicators are that people are fed up with this Democratic Party and its non-response to incredibly stressful times. So what do? You come before the people and you say, we are of one mind. Yes, I know, you know, the Obamacare and so forth, but that is not my fault. That is Congress, an unwilling Congress that is fighting me. I can't, the Republicans, those evil, nasty Republicans, we can't get them to do the right thing. As if Obamacare is the right thing. The president finally speaks at length about race and class and equality. This is great. It is good to know that he had the capacity to actually get the point. 5 years late, but he is getting the point. He has gotten the point. So where is the response? He talked a lot about education. His administration has closed more schools than any other administration up until this point. Most of those schools serve black children and Latino children. He talked about opportunity. You know, that old thing about you want to be given. People need to have the opportunity to do things. He talked about merit, as if to suggest by implication that in fact this is how the world works, by merit. I mean, what, where has he been living? Since when has America operated on the basis of merit and hard work? So he's recognizing the problem, but that is only for argument's sake. He's not interested in the fine details of the problem. The implication when he says a phrase like that about merit and hard work, these are the code words for people who basically aren't getting anywhere because they're lazy. And, you know, while he says this is not, the world has come to look at this as a problem associated with minorities, but it's an across-the-board problem. But we know who he's talking to. And we know who he's talking about. All these platitudes mean nothing. They only suggest that this president is, in fact, conscious of the great divides in America. But neither he nor his party, nor the Republicans, have been able to deliver a workable solution. That's what people want. They want a solution to a problem. They don't want the problem further explained because they are living it. They want a solution. And the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the president, they all have demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt that they are incapable of providing a solution. The polls are reflecting that. People, in fact, have an opinion of Congress that is the lowest it has ever been since it's been measured. There's a reason. all that talk is not squaring against the solutions that people are seeking. They're not getting solutions. So never mind the wonderful things and the great insights and, you know, invoking the name of presidents, previous presidents, and what they did. By implication saying, you know, we got this from Lincoln. Lincoln gave us land-grant colleges. It's also I just want to mention, by the way, that the president needs to read a little bit about African-American history to get that straight. What Roosevelt gave us and what LBJ gave us. And, of course, he's saying, I'm giving you Obamacare. I'm giving you an economy. It's revved up. We're doing better. It is not squaring against the facts. It is not squaring against the facts. When you say that, when he says that, for example, he's making sure that the economy works for everybody. Now, you can't tell me this with a straight face. I'm so happy I wasn't actually in the audience. I would have had an outburst or two. Is this president serious when he says that? The economy, make sure that the economy works for everybody. Is that what we have been experiencing? The economy working for everybody? Has he taken a look at the unemployment rate for African Americans, Latinos, teenagers? Has he really done that kind of homework? That's basic stuff. Is the economy working for everybody? Is everybody suffering or achieving the same? He is talking about the income inequality gap, which he is clear. He's saying so himself. He's so clear that it is wide, very wide, the widest it has been in decades. And at the same time, is saying to folks, but look at how many good things are working. The economy is working. He's just saying there's income inequality, and then he says the economy is working. And before people said that this was just about African Americans, this is a non-white problem, but now, look, the intersection of race and class, he's now articulating the intersection of race and class. And even as he does that, he is still addressing white America. He's talking to the so-called middle class. I have no idea who those are. Who are those folks? Not in the African American community. By far, they are. There isn't enough of a black population to be considered middle class. So he is using this whole issue of race while he is raising it ostensibly within the environment, like I said, the so-called allegedly liberal leaning environment. So he feels at home to talk this way because that's the way they talk. To convince everybody that they're liberal. But when it comes to the bottom line is that the issue still remains, even with all of the permutations that are being experienced throughout this country, the issue still remains that there are black folks, Latinos, Native Americans at the very bottom rung of the ladder of this so-called proactive president. His administration has not moved that percentage upward. In fact, it's even worse. The unemployment rate among African Americans, for example, is the highest it has been since the 1920s. All right? So when this black president gets up and starts talking, he says, now I'm talking to you, my people, my peeps. He's priming the pump so that people will soften the blow. You know, we're going into 2014, and this is the preamble, the conditioning of the population to accept a direct plea for help, because there's so much work to be done. The fact is, he's had 5 years. The fact also is that the constituencies that put him in office with specific concerns, with specific issues that needed to be attended to urgently, have not gotten a good deal. They have not been attended. They have not had, even in minimal ways, their needs, their crucial needs met by this particular president and his administration. When you listen to the president, he talks on several levels. Again, he didn't miss the opportunity to remind the American public that his father left the household and his mother had to strive to make ends meet. And, you know, the implication again, this is what makes me a typical black guy. As a matter of fact, Bill Clinton's mother left, father left the household too. A very bruised household. So that is not a message that we need to hear anymore, Mr. President. We get it. Your father left the household. Apparently you don't know why. You know, you should be able to tell people why. Right after you make the statement, something like that, say why. Well, we're coming to the end of this program today, and we had an interruption. We had a mechanical issue, a technical issue that, in fact, has been resolved, but late into the program. So tomorrow, we will pursue this discussion. We already have some guests lined up tomorrow. We'll be visiting an aspect of Detroit, again, at a very high level tomorrow. And we will use the rest of the time to kind of recap this discussion and to see the significance of the speech, because it is really very important to listen to, because the president spent in excess of about 50 minutes talking, and that is considerable for any head of state to address a group. And clearly it was because there are some things that hinge upon it, so the speech is important for us to listen to. I want to thank you for your forbearance today. If you're listening to this program this late, you may also want to access it via the archives. And I will post something on the Facebook page to let people know that they can do that. But we will return to the speech tomorrow and have that discussion more fully. You want to stay tuned. Coming up next is Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Leet. Thanks so much for your patience today. I really, really appreciate it. And these things happen, but, you know, we have to just muddle through. So as troopers, we'll come back to each other tomorrow, same time. Bye-bye.
Blues is what they call him. Way down Mexico way.